Just to switch over to my demo machine. Okay, so I'm going to start with just a couple of minutes of a trip down memory lane. Okay, so how many of you were doing web stuff back in 1998? Ooh, a good number. Maybe a half. Okay, that's cool. Anyone go back much further? Maybe 95? One? Ooh, wow. Who's the oldest? Anyone doing it in 93? 94? Okay, you, sir. Do you have positive memories of web development from 1994? So, all right. Okay, well, so many of you youngsters don't recall how it was back then, so this is a quick two-minute history lesson. All right, so this is how we're going to build something called a website, because, you know, they're all the rage, and you can make a lot of money out of this stuff. So, all right, first I have to log in, but I can't remember my password from 1998, so we just cancel that. That's fine. Security wasn't too hot back then. And now we want to build this web application, website thing. So we're going to need to start off by firing up our IDE. So where's the IDE? That I think is here, built into Windows. And write a little bit of HTML. So let's have hello world. All right. Now we're going to want to get some investors in our hot new startup, so we'll need some special effects. Let's have the marquee, okay, and construction, because everything was back then. All right, and just to show that we're really hot web developers, let's have a little bit of script in there as well. Let's say welcome to the visitors. All right then. Okay, now how do we get to run this? Well, pretty straightforward. Save the file onto the desktop. Okay, now I've got the idea for this company to be called google.com. So this is my prototype. And save that with an HTML extension. Okay, and then to run it, obviously, just double-click it, and it runs in your browser. Yeah! So here is my script running, and you can see the special effects in the background there, and the investors are just leaping at us with money now. So that's all very well. It might seem a little silly to be doing that, and yeah, it's also primitive back then. Yeah, really basic stuff. But there's actually some really positive stuff about the developer experience there. It was actually quite fun, you know. I didn't have to install anything. I just opened up a text editor and wrote some text and saved it. And then when I want to run it, I don't have to compile. I don't have to deploy. I just open it in a browser, and it's super easy, and it's really nice. And so you're thinking, yeah, what on earth does that have to do with anything we're doing today? And, well, in 2013, we've built a lot of sophisticated technologies that go a long way beyond this, but in some ways, they might make the development process a little slower. And, you know, you have to do more stuff. You have to install more stuff. You have to compile more stuff and all that kind of thing. So, all right, that's enough for Windows 98. Let me just introduce myself. My name's Steve, I work for Microsoft, and I'm on this team that builds Windows Azure Mobile Services, which you're going to be hearing a lot about during this talk. And I'm a developer on that team, so you will see a lot more code than slides during this talk, but I will just start off with a few slides to set some context. So, it's really nice to do web development just working with some static files, with your HTML, CSS, and your JavaScript. And it's fun, but can you really go very far with this? You know, can you build a sophisticated, large, rich web application just with these kind of static files? Well, the people who use these JavaScript libraries would probably say, yeah, you can build very rich, sophisticated applications like that. You may have heard of some of these model view libraries in JavaScript, like Angular, Knockout, Backbone, Ember, those kind of things. Hands up, anyone used any of those? Yeah, so it's a good number. A lot of people are into this kind of thing. And in fact, there's a whole section of our industry now, front-end web development, that's primarily about this, building stuff with HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. And people love it. You know, front-end web developers are delighted with this kind of thing. It sets their dreams free to float away into the sky and make lots of money. And that's marvelous. But it's not really enough, is it? So you can build all the MVVM stuff in the browser that you like, but you're still going to need a back end, because somewhere along the way, you're going to have some way of storing data. You're going to have some way of sharing it between users. You're going to have the ability to log people in. You're going to need to write business logic on the server, because you can't trust what the clients are doing all the time. And you might need to integrate with other servers, like other back-end systems in your organization, and you can't do that directly from a browser. So you've got to have some kind of back-end somewhere along the line. How are you going to build your back-end? Well, of course you can spin up the back-end with all your traditional web technologies, whether that's ASP.NET, Rails, Node, whatever it is that you like. And that's fine. But it takes a lot of time, and there's a lot of stuff that you potentially have to do. So wouldn't it be nice if you could just use a back-end that someone else had built for you? What if there was a back-end that just existed already, and you could sign up and use it right now? And obviously, that's what this talk is about. So there's this whole thing within the industry called back-end as a service, and that is this exact idea. Someone else has created the data storage place, the thing that does all the authentication, all that back-end stuff. You can sign up and use it. And that's what I'm going to talk about. Specifically, I'm going to talk about Microsoft's take on this, which is the backend as a service built into Windows Azure, Windows Azure Mobile Services. Now, I understand this wasn't covered in the keynote this morning, which, you know, frankly, I don't know what they were thinking with that keynote and missing out possibly the hottest thing that Microsoft is doing right now. But how many of you have seen this thing before? Okay, all right, that's about a third of you. All right, so for the rest of you, this is all new. And for those of you who have seen it, you probably haven't seen it done as a web with web technologies yet. So mobile services is a place where you can store some data in the cloud. You can do authentication using custom credentials or Facebook, Twitter, Microsoft, or Google accounts. You can write custom server logic in JavaScript, which runs on a Node backend. You can send push notifications to Apple, Google, and Microsoft devices. You can do boring things like monitor to make sure your site's not falling down and scale it up to handle lots of traffic. And this whole thing is cross-platform. And what I mean by that is, not only are, at the lowest level, the service we're providing is built on HTTP REST-style APIs. So you can connect to it from anything you like. But we also provide SDKs for all of the major platforms in the world right now, which are Windows Store, iPhone and iPad, Android, and Windows Phone 7.5, Windows Phone 8, and, most recently, HTML and JavaScript applications. And these SDKs are all open source on GitHub. So this is a very open, extensible kind of thing. Now, let's have a go at actually using this from a web application, because most of you who've seen this before will probably have seen it in the context of native applications, iOS, Android, Windows Phone. But I want to do this for a website. So let's jump over to this other demo machine here. And I'm in the Azure control panel, as you can see. And you can see that this is the mobile services tab down the left here. Now, since I work on this product, I've got lots of mobile services already that I use for various things. You can just ignore them, pretend they're not there, and we'll create a brand new one for this demo. So I'm going to create a new mobile service. And it needs me to give it a name. So let's call it Tech Ed Web. Okay, and it'll check the name's available, and it is, good. So I can connect it either to existing databases or one or new database. Now I've already got a database, so I'll just use that, and I'll give it my credentials for that database. And now it is creating in the background while we wait. And that'll take about 20 seconds. So while we wait, I'm going to show you a bit of the management interface for a different mobile service that I've already got. So let's jump into, let's say, Task Tracker here. And you can see that when we go into this, this is a cloud backend that you're ready to connect your app to. And the first thing it offers is this Getting Started guide to each of the platforms that we support, Windows Store, Windows Phone, iOS, and so on. And it gives you instructions for creating new apps or connecting existing ones in each case. And we'll follow some of these in just a few minutes. There is also a handy dashboard, so you can see what your app is doing. And you can also explore any data that's in your app. This one has none right now. And then you can do many other things like set up custom APIs and so on. And we'll get into that later on in this talk. Assuming that my laptop is not broken. Okay, so the trackpad on my laptop and keyboard have just died. That's going to present some trouble for us, I would say, during this. Okay, is it back? The trackpad is not back, but I can use a mouse. Okay, right, we will carry on anyway, despite the weirdness of what my laptop is doing right now. Serves you right for using a Mac in a Microsoft presentation. Okay, so while I've been waffling, the app that we created in the background has finished creating. And you can see that we can choose what platform we want to use. So let's say we want to create an HTML and JavaScript application, a brand new one, if you please. And I'm not going to focus on the to-do example throughout much of this talk, but I'm going to start with the to-do example just for the first few minutes to set a bit more context. So this three-step tutorial that's built into the management process, management portal, suggests that firstly you create a table to store to-do items, and secondly, you can download a ready-made project that works with your backend that you've just created. So let's do that. I will download this now, and that will download as a zip file, and let's extract that. So extract all contents of there. And when we go into there, you can see that the files that we've got are HTML, JavaScript, and CSS. So it's your classic front-end technologies. But there's also this mysterious server folder. Now, what would we put in there? Well, the server folder is completely optional. If you have got your own way of setting up a web server, or you want to import these files into an existing project, you can do that, and you can just delete the server folder. But if you're just getting started, and you fancy a bit of help to create a local web server to serve those files, then all you have to do is just click one of these files for Linux, Mac, or Windows. So let's run the Windows one, and it'll give me numerous security prompts. And after it's eventually done that, then it will start running a local web server. So let's go to that now. That's on localhost port 8000. Here we go. And you can see it's a very simple little to-do application that's been set up as a demonstration of all the APIs. So let's store some items. Let's have do this demo. And then let's have go to the park. I don't know. Random things. OK. So we've got a couple of items in our list there. And if I reload this page, you'll see that they don't get lost. They're stored somewhere. Do you know where they're stored? Can you guess? In Azure, yes. The clue is in the session title. So if you go into this data tab here, you'll see that the data that's been stored is in Azure, in the mobile service backend. There are the both of the items there. So you can now start programming against that and let different users share that data and work together. And so I'm sure you're thinking, yeah, that's fine, but what does the code look like? Is it a nice API, and do I want to work with this? So let me show you what the API is like. Now, let's go back to this getting started thing and pretend this time that you're connecting an existing app. So the first step it suggests is add a script reference to this mobile services JavaScript client library. Now, I've already got that, so we can ignore it. And then the next thing is create an instance of a mobile service client, pointing that to the HTTP endpoint that it lives on and this app identifier key thing at the bottom that you can largely ignore. All right, so I copy that. And I'm going to do this in the Chrome debug console, just so that we can sort of do it live. So let's just reorganize the window slightly. And I will paste in that code. OK, so if I run that now, then I've now got an instance of a mobile service client. Right, now I want to start reading some stuff out of the table that's in there. So let's go client.getTable. And let's get hold of the to-do item table. All right, and then we can read stuff out of there. Now, that thing returns a promise because it's asynchronous. And so we can say, then, when you finish getting that data, call this callback function. OK, and what will I do with the data? Well, I'm just going to log it to the console. OK, so we're going to get the table, get the data from it, log it to the console, hopefully. If I run that now, you'll see first it returns a promise. And then when the promise completes, it returns these two objects out of the mobile service in the cloud there. So very, very simple API for fetching data back from the server. How about inserting stuff? Well, that's a predictably simple thing as well. So let's have text do another thing complete false. OK. And so now I can hit go on that, and it will insert it, hopefully. And let's try reading stuff back. And this time you'll see we've got three records. And the last one there is the do another thing. All right. So very, very simple API for storing data in this mobile service from a web application. And as it's set up right now, the client is able to access any table in the database, and it can insert, update, read, or delete any data it likes with no restrictions. And there's no control over the schema. There's no validation. There's no authentication or anything like that. Anybody anticipate a potential problem with this scenario? I think any web developer in the room knows that you don't want to just have complete trust for the clients that are talking to your server. You want to be able to control what they can do and what they can't do. So you have to be able to write some logic on the server. How can we do that? Well, for mobile services, it's very easy, because if I go into this table here, the to-do item table, you'll see there's a script tab. And I go into there, and you will also see that we allow you to write script that runs on insert, update, delete, or read. And this is JavaScript, but it's not running in a browser. It's going to run on the server in Azure. And so you can write some custom code to control exactly what people can do with your mobile service backend. So as a very simple example, let's impose a very strange business rule that everything you enter has to be in uppercase characters. Well, I can implement that very easily. I can just take whatever item text you have supplied, item.text, and then say, make that uppercase. Okay, and then I'll hit save on that. And that logic will run on the server when someone tries to do an insert. So if I go back over here, and then I'll insert blah, blah, okay, in lowercase, and then I go on that, and then when I read the data back, you'll see we've got four objects now, and then the last of those objects is blah, blah in uppercase, because the server-side logic obviously ran. And you can use this server-side logic to implement any kind of business rule. You can also use it to implement various different security matters, and I'll show you some examples of that shortly. You can also use it to make HTTP calls out to third-party services in order to interoperate with any other kind of third-party system that you want to make your mobile service work with. And I'll show you an example of that later on in this talk. Okay. But anyway, that's all I want to show you of the to-do list example. Anyone got any questions about that at this point? No. Okay. So precisely explained that there are no questions. Right then. So enough about to-do lists already. Let's find a slightly more interesting example so that we can build a larger, more realistic web application. So a little bit of role playing at this point. Imagine that you've been brought in as a highly paid consultant to one of Madrid's taxi companies, the Spa Taxi Company, and they've brought you in for a very short project, just a few days of highly paid work, to build them an entirely new web-based taxi booking system. And it's got to be the best web-based taxi booking system in the whole of Madrid. So the idea is people can go to it on whatever device they like, and they don't have to enter all their user details every time. They can log in and store their user profile. And when they do log in, they can use Twitter logins and Facebook logins and that sort of thing, because, you know, the kids do that kind of stuff. And then they can place bookings, and there'll be a nice, rich, graphical booking interface with maps and such like. And then they can see their bookings, but the coolest thing is they can even see the taxis on the map in real time, driving around on the map, coming towards them to pick them up. So they can see how long it's going to be until the taxi gets there by watching it drive around on the map. And that's what your job is to do. And you don't have very long to do it, so you'll want to take advantage of Azure Mobile Services, because it provides a backend that's just marvelous for this kind of thing. And we're going to do it as a web application. So there are going to be a few different stages in building this application. None of them are very difficult. The first stage is being able to load and save data. And you've already seen how we can do that. So I'm going to go through that again. You'll see another example and a few more aspects to it. But then you'll also see how it's possible to add security, real security, not just making things uppercase, where people have to actually log in and what they do is controlled. So we'll do that. And then you'll see how we can use these front-end technologies to build the rest of the application very quickly without needing anything complicated, any back-end server rendering. And then finally, I'm going to show you how we can turn on the real-time and be able to see the taxi data moving around in real-time. And then I've got some other cool stuff to show you as well. But anyway, let's get started with the storing of data. So back over here. Now, because you are a very highly paid web developer, you don't want to be bothered with trivial details like actually writing HTML or CSS or whatever. So they've gone and got some low-paid web designer to come and provide a basic design for this application for you. And this is your starting point. So the idea is that it's going to be, it's going to look like this. You're going to have this weird yellow header thing. And then we've got a three-tab system. First tab, the users can log in and register themselves. On the second tab, they'll be able to place bookings, saying where they want to go from to and what time. And then on the third tab, they'll be able to see what bookings they've already got and more cool stuff. But right now, this is all just dummy test data. And it's up to us to fill this in with a real application. So I'm going to use Visual Studio. You don't strictly have to use Visual Studio for this. You can use any text editor because there's no server-side code. But Visual Studio happens to be very good at editing HTML and JavaScript, so I'm going to use that. All right. And I'm also going to build part of the user interface with a JavaScript library called Knockout.js, which is a model view view model library for JavaScript. You don't have to know this at all, because I'm not going to go into very much detail about it during this talk. So if you know about Knockout already, good for you. And if you don't, doesn't matter at all. You'll hopefully understand it just as well anyway. But just your sort of 30-second intro. With it being a model view view model system, the idea is to split up your client-side code into views, which describe what's on the screen. So here's the view in my application, this HTML here. So a view is some HTML. And it gets bound through these bindings to a view model. And the view model is kind of a code behind or just some other object-oriented representation of what's going on in this view. And in this particular example, I've got two properties on my view model. I'm keeping track of whether or not we're currently loading, and I'm keeping track of the profile data that we've got for the current user. And all I'm doing right now is if we're currently loading, we display this loading message. And if not, then, well, nothing really happens. And I've got this fake profile data right now. So I would like to show the actual profile data on the screen. So I'm going to drop in a little bit of view markup. You don't want to watch me type because it would take too long and I would get typos. So I'm going to drop in snippets like this. So you see in this snippet here, I'm saying if we've got some profile data, then I want to display these two text boxes. The first one displays the username and the second one displays the user's phone number and the user can edit that. So if I save that and jump back to the browser, then you'll see now that we've got these two text boxes on the screen there and that's great. But if I edit stuff in here and hit reload, I just lose the changes, and that's not great. But it's not surprising either, because there's no code that attempts to save the data. There's no data access at all. So let's put some real data access in instead of this fake data. We're going to want a backend to store this in, and of course we'll use Azure Mobile Services. So I've already created a mobile service called Spar Taxi, where we're going to store all this stuff. And you'll see I've got a couple of tables already. I've got bookings and taxis, and we can ignore those for now. We'll come to them later. And for now, I'm going to create a new table called Profiles, where we store user profile information. We won't worry about permissions just yet. We'll get onto that later on. So let's create that. And when that table has been created, we will be able to go into there. And what have I done here? We will be able to go into that table. I'm getting lost. Data, profiles, here we go. And see what data is in there. Right now there's nothing, but let's start working with it. So even though there's no data in that table right now, that doesn't stop us from trying to load some data from it. So on the client, let's use the same API that you've seen before. I've created a function called loadProfile, and you'll see that what it does is, just like in the Chrome debugger, I wrote get table and then read, I'm using exactly the same API to access a table called profiles on the back end. And I'm setting is loading to true at beginning and then to false afterwards so that we get the correct loading indicator. Okay, so hopefully we'll have loaded some data from the profiles table. And now we want to actually use it in some way. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to grab the first record that's come back. The response is an array, and we're just going to pull the first entry out of that array and use it. And we'll take care of getting the right data later on. But for now, we'll just use whatever the first record is that comes back. And if there is an existing record, we'll use that. And if there isn't, we'll use this blank record instead. So all we have to do now is when the view model starts up, we'll call loadProfile. And that should hopefully get it to actually try and load some data. But we know there isn't any data, so it should display a blank record. Let's try it. So I'll hit reload, and it's loading. And then when the query on the server completes, which it will do very soon, I'm sure, then we've got no data back, so it shows a blank record. All right, that's good. So I could start entering some stuff here, but there's still no save button. So let's add a save button, and that can use an insert, just like you saw me write before. So I'll drop a save button in here and tidy that up a little bit so you can read it. Okay. Right, so my save button regular HTML button with some CSS class on it and a text. And I'm saying, when the user clicks on this button, this is knockout here, when the user clicks on this button, I want to call something on the view model called save profile. So I better define this save profile thing. What logic is going to be in there? Well, it's going to be pretty straightforward. Firstly, we need to know, is it an update or an insert that we're doing? And we can decide based on whether or not there's an ID. So if we've got an ID already, it's an existing record, so we can get the profiles table and update this record in it. And if there is no ID, it's a new record, so we'll do an insert instead. Let's try it, shall we? Come back over here, reload, and now let's sign myself up, put my real phone number in there, hit save profile. And then if that worked, I can come back over to the management portal and refresh, and we should see that the data that I entered into that form has gone up to the mobile service and has been stored there. And there it is. Now you may be thinking, hang on, you didn't even declare a schema for that table, so how does it know to have ID, name, and phone in it? And the answer to that is we have this feature called dynamic schema in mobile services. The idea with dynamic schema is when you're developing your application rapidly, you don't always want to keep thinking about adding columns to tables all the time. So wouldn't it be nice if we could automatically update your schema based on the data that your UI is sending to the back end? So this gives you some of the same convenience that you get with a NoSQL database, where you don't have to define a schema, but with all the benefits of a real SQL database as well, because this is actually SQL Server behind the scenes here. So you've still got all the ability to do relational things like joining tables and running aggregate queries and that sort of thing, but you still don't have to define the schema up front. Now, little caveat to that is, when you go to production, you should turn that off. And yeah, because otherwise people might just send you unexpected data and you'll start storing it. So we've got this massive blue button here on the configure tab with the enable dynamic schema feature, and you should turn that off when you go to production. But anyway, I'm leaving it on for this talk because it's very convenient. And let's just check one last thing. If I reload, hopefully it will fetch the data back from the server, and it does. And if I edit it, Stephen, some other phone number, if I hit save, it should know not to do an insert because it's already got an ID. It should know just to do an update. So let's reload and check that it did do the update. Okay, that's good. Right then. So we're doing pretty well, I would say, for the first 10 minutes of our development task. We've been able to store data in this cloud backend. Now, where are we going to go from here? So we've done basic data storage, but right now, our application is not really good enough because everybody who goes to this website is going to have the same profile record. There's effectively one giant global profile that everyone in the world shares, and that is not really what our customer wants in this particular case. They want to have different profile records for everybody who goes to the site. And that introduces a little bit of a security concern because you don't want people to see or change each other's profile records. So you're going to need to have some way of logging people in and then writing authentication and authorization logic. So how about doing some of that. Now, how are we going to do the login and authentication? Well, the first thing I want to do is I want to actually enforce the rule that you have to be logged in order to be able to edit a profile. Because right now, it doesn't matter whether you're logged in or not. Now, I could write some custom script to force people to log in, but there's an even easier way, which is to go to this permissions tab here. And you'll see on the permissions tab, I can control for each of these operations that people have to be authenticated. And that means that they have to be logged in. The other permissions options are there's everyone and everyone with the application key. These are basically the same because anybody can find out what your application key is. So there's no point really in differentiating those. Authentication to users means that you have to be logged in, and scripts and admins means that you can't invoke it from the web, except if you've got a special secret key that, that end users don't have. Okay, so let's save that now. So now it should not be possible to load our data into this web application because I'm not logged in. So let's try it. If I hit reload, hopefully it will not get the data back this time. And you see, it does not get it back. It's stuck on loading. And if I look in the browser console, you'll see, failed to load resource. The server responded, 401 unauthorized. So the back end is not going to play nicely now with anybody who's not logged in. So we better do login. And then the question is, how are we going to do login? And what does it mean to login? Well, if you want to set up a login system, one way that you could do it is you could go to this list of tables, and you can define a table of your own called users or something like that, and then you can put user records in it, and you can implement your own registration screen and your own password reset screen and all that boring stuff. But what if you didn't have to do that? What if you could use login accounts that people had already got? Well, Mobile Services supports 4 different authentication providers out of the box. Microsoft accounts, Google accounts, Facebook, and Twitter accounts. You're not limited to those. We've also got APIs for providing custom tokens. So if you want to connect with some other custom backend or some other social network or whatever that you want to, you can generate your own tokens for it. But we will do the work for you with all these ones that are up here. Behind the scenes, it uses OAuth, and we have been through the pain of figuring out how Twitter's OAuth API is different to the spec and all that kind of stuff, so you don't have to. You can just use the API. So let's have a go at setting up some logins. Now, since this is aimed at consumers, this application, we probably want to use something like Facebook or Twitter logins. That would be quite nice for a lot of users. So in this case, let's say we want to use Twitter. Right, how are we going to set up Twitter logins? Well, first job, go over to this identity tab here, and you'll see that we let you configure how to work with Microsoft accounts, Facebook, Twitter, or Google. And I've already set some stuff up for Google, just in case if I have to use it, if Twitter's down today, sometimes it is. But let's be optimistic and hope that Twitter is working today, and we'll try and use that. And you'll see that we have to enter a consumer key and a consumer secret, and you probably think, what is that? And I will answer that question. So if you want to work with Twitter, the thing you do is you go to this website, dev.twitter.com, and you log in with your Twitter account, and you say, I want to be a Twitter developer. And that's free, and it only takes a few minutes, unless you read all the terms and conditions, in which case it takes you a week. But let's assume that you've done that, and you've registered. Then you can register your app with Twitter. And when you've registered your app, which is also free, they will give you back all of these various tokens and URLs. And the relevant ones for us are consumer key. So let's copy that and paste that into the management portal there. And then also consumer secret, which I will copy and paste into there and hit save. And what these are used for is the OAuth protocol that runs between your mobile service and the Twitter servers. And because Twitter can see that you've got these keys, they will allow you to know who is logged in to Twitter. Okay, so that's good. That's a good start. But in our user interface, there's still no Twitter login screen. In fact, there's no login button at all. So how about we better add that? Let's start by putting a login button on the screen. Okay, so I'm going to drop a login button. Where shall I put that? I'll put that down here. Okay, that's not the login button. This is the login button. Okay, so it's a regular HTML button, and when you click it, it's going to call a function called login, which we haven't defined yet. But we don't want to display it if they're already logged in, and we don't want to display it if we're currently in the process of loading the profile. So we're only going to display it if this expression is false. Okay, and then when the user clicks this button, it will call login, and so we better define what login is. Login is very, very simple. If you want to display a Twitter, Google, Facebook, or Microsoft login prompt, it's a one-liner, because this login function is built into the Mobile Services SDK. You just say who you want to log in with, and we will do the rest. And then there's a callback that runs after the user has logged in successfully. So in this case, after the user has logged in, we'll load their profile record. And that is hopefully all that you have to do. One last thing, though. You see this line of code here? This is the one that was triggering the 401 unauthorized error, because it's trying to load the user's profile before they're logged in. So let's stop triggering that error now, and we'll say we'll only load the profile if the user is, in fact, logged in already. So if the backend has a current user, then we will load their profile. If not, then we'll wait until they've logged in before we will load that. Let's try it, shall we? So back in the browser, we've now got the login button. So I will hit this login with Twitter. And what comes up is, not surprisingly, a Twitter login prompt. This is all provided by Twitter. They can update that UI anytime they like. Obviously, you get a very different UI for Google, Facebook, or whatever. So I'll log in with my fake Twitter account here. And I will say, authorize this app. Okay, and then the load profile callback fires, and it can go to the server, and this time it doesn't say 401. This time it says 200 OK, here's your data, thank you very much, and you are able to work with this user's profile now. So that's great. We have used Twitter, and we can find out who the user is. But we've still not solved the real problem here, which is how do we get a different profile record for every user? What would be really nice would be if on our table called profiles, there was a column here that instead of just having ID, name, and phone, there was an extra column called something like user ID or owner ID or something like that, and that would tie the profile record to the person who owns that record. It would be nice if we could do that. Obviously, we can, so let's do it. Let's write a little bit of script. So what I'm going to do is say that when somebody inserts a new profile record, I want to add an extra property to it. So I'm going to add a property called user ID. And that's just an arbitrary name. I could call it anything I like, but user ID is a good name for a user ID. And what value shall I give to that? Well, I'll give it the value user.userID. Now, user is the parameter that's passed into this function, and it tells you who is currently logged in. So this is cryptographically verified. You know for sure that whatever value this is, that's who the person really is logged in as. And we're going to stamp that onto each profile record that gets created. So then we will know who owns each profile. And that solves half of the problem. The next problem, the next half, is how do we restrict people to only getting their own data? Well, that's very, very easy, because we can go over onto the read script here, and we'll say when somebody tries to read some data, we'll take whatever query they're trying to do, and we'll add an extra where clause onto that query. And the where clause will say, we're only giving you records where the user ID value on that record equals the user ID that you're logged in as. So now you can't see anyone else's data. And you can't see any data that's not associated with anyone either. You can only see data that's, that is associated with your user record. Let's see if this works, shall we? Because right now, this record is not associated with my user ID. It's not associated with anyone. So if I hit reload, I shouldn't be able to see that. I should just get a blank record instead. So if I reload, then when this comes up, you see we're back to blank now because I'm not allowed to see that other one. So let's put in a new one. Let's have Twitter user. And login, phone number, blah, blah. Okay, I'll save that. And if that's worked, then Dynamic Schema should have automatically created a new column called user ID, and it will be populated with the Twitter ID that is currently logged in. And you can see there it is. And if I hit reload, I should be able to get that record back. Because I'm logged in as that record, that's the one it's going to return to me, and I can't see any other records. So that's good. We've accomplished what we wanted to accomplish right there. So far, we've been able to store some data in the mobile service, loading and saving. And then we've been able to add login support using Twitter, and it would be trivial to change it to Google or whatever. And we've been able to write some custom authorization logic on the server just by writing a little bit of custom script. So that is really good. We're halfway there or so. Now, how about we finish the rest of this application user interface? And we can start to go a little bit faster now, because we really know what we're doing. So I'd like to put in these create bookings and my bookings screens. And we can do this pretty quickly. So the create booking screen has got these three text boxes on it. And let's see the implementation that I've already got so far. So if I jump over to the create booking file, you see that the view here consists of these three text boxes. We've got the from text box, the to, and the time. And these are all bound onto model values using Knockout. And so I've got three properties on the view model, from, to, and time. And the top two are just blank, and then the time is initialized to be the current time plus 15 minutes, because you know that's probably about when you want your taxi. And we're telling Knockout to track all that stuff. And what that means is if someone enters something into the view, it should update the view model automatically. And if your code changes the view model, that should update the view automatically. So that's what this ko.track line does. Okay, so let's make this application user interface a little bit nicer. First thing is, I'd like to display a nice map to show where the user is going from and to. And I can do that just using Knockout by reusing some existing code. So because this is model view view model, if we're going to have a map, we should have a model, a view model, for what information is being displayed in that map. So here is a view model for that, called map model, I'm declaring it as. And I'm declaring it as an instance of RootPicker view model, which is just some reusable code that defines a route that you can pick on a map. And that's just view model stuff. I want to display it on the view as well. So let's drop in an element. I'll have a div with some class. And I want to bind it to this map model that I've just declared. And I'm binding it with the root picker binding, which is just more reusable code. So hopefully there'll be a nice little root picker now. Don't worry about if you're not familiar with Knockout. Just accept that we've got a little map. So let's see it. If I hit reload, then don't get anything. So what have I done wrong here? Let's see. Dum, dum, dum. Sorry, what was that? I can't hear you. Sorry. Anyway, I've got a X is not defined. What's that? Oh, yeah. Okay. Thank you. That is what you were saying, isn't it? Okay. So we'll fix the typo in my code and hit reload. And then we do see the map. Okay. So we can see now, here's a handy little map. And let's try and declare a route that we want to take. So I can click on a few points on this map. And because everything is bound together, that will update these text boxes. And also, if I want to edit the text boxes, then that should update the map as well. It's kind of a long journey there. OK, so that's good. But we still have no way of actually submitting this booking to the server. So let's add a save booking button on. And I can use exactly the same APIs that you've already seen. So we can go quickly here. Firstly, I'll drop in a button, and you can see that it says place booking, and it's visible only if the user has picked a route, and when they click it, we're going to call save. So what is save? Well, that doesn't exist yet. Let's declare save, and that can use the same APIs as before, except we're storing quite a lot of data this time. So we're storing where we're going from, where we're going to. We store the from and to GPS coordinates. As well, just in case that's useful. And we'll store the time that the user wants to go. And once we've grabbed all this data together, we'll insert it into the bookings table. And assuming that succeeds, then we'll do a redirection to the list of bookings. So let's see if it works. So I'll reload, and I'll pick a nice little route on the map from here to here. And then, is that seriously the best route? I'm not convinced that this taxi driver knows where to go. But anyway, let's place booking. And then if that's worked, I should be able to go to the bookings table and see the record that I've just entered there. And Dynamic Schema has sorted out all of the columns that are necessary. So that's good. Let's just drop in one more booking as well so that we can make a nice list of them. So let's go from Madrid to back home to London. Don't know how the taxi does that. But anyway, we'll place that booking. And then back in the list here, we've got the two items in the list. Very good. Okay. So that's creating a booking and storing it in the mobile service. Now I want to implement this My Bookings list. As you can see, at the moment, it's just displaying fake test data. And we want to replace that with real data. So on the My Bookings tab, you can see that what the view does so far is it displays the number of bookings, that's bookings.length, and then for each of those bookings, it's going to create a list item, and on each of those items, we'll display the from, to, and time values. So that's how this user interface gets generated. And in terms of the code behind that, the main view model here has got this array on it called bookings, and array is initially populated to these three fake items that say here and there and so on. And each entry in this list is a booking view model. So we've got multiple levels of nested view models here. And the booking view model declares all of the properties that a single booking would have, ID, from, to, and time. Okay, very good. But we don't really want to show this fake data. We actually want to load real data from the server. So I can use the same APIs for like the fourth time now to fetch data from my mobile service. So backend, get this table bookings. We can order the data in a certain way. Then we'll read the data. And then when we've got this data back, we want to do something with it. And what do we want to do? Well, we want to populate the bookings array with that data. So let's drop in bit more code here to populate self.bookings. And what I'm doing is I don't just want raw data. I want an array of booking view model instances. So I'm using this utility function called map that iterates over the array that's come back from the server. And for each entry in that array, it constructs a booking view model with that data. And then it's going to assign the resulting array to self.bookings. So hopefully the real data will now show up on the screen. So go back and hit reload, and it will go to the server, and it will load these two records that have come back. OK, that's good. Let's finish this, finally, now, by actually displaying some nice little maps that show the start and end points for these routes. So once again, I can reuse some code to do with maps. And I want to add a little bit of extra model data to the booking view model to declare which points I want to plot on a map. And here is what I want to do. I'm going to create an array of markers that we want to populate, and they'll have some text, and the first one will display the from position, and the second one will display the to position. And when I've got that data, I can bind it all onto a map on the screen using a reusable binding called map. And that will take this list of markers and use them. And I'm going to do a bit of animation in a minute, so I'm also declaring a slide duration, but we won't need to worry about that just now. But hopefully just those few lines of code will result in getting some nice maps. So you can see this first booking starts in Madrid, goes to London. The second booking follows that little route there. And we're doing pretty well with our application. I think our employers would be kind of impressed with our first day's work or so there. So we've been able to store data, we can load it back, we can do logins, we can do authorization, and we've finished off most of the parts of the user interface. But here's where it gets more interesting. We want to make this real time. We want to be able to see where the taxis are in real time and plot them moving around on those maps. Now, if this was a native application for Windows Phone, iOS, Android, you would probably want to use the push notifications feature that those devices have, which is also built into mobile services. But it's not. It's a web application. So what's the closest equivalent to push notifications? Any suggestions? Signal R is very close to... It is very close to native push notifications. And what does Signal R use behind the scenes? WebSockets, yes. Now, on the server here, I don't have an ASP.NET application. So I can't use Signal R, sadly. But I do have an Azure Mobile Service, and behind the scenes, an Azure Mobile Service is a Node.js application. Now, Node.js allows me to make HTTP requests to arbitrary third-party services. So even though there's no built-in sockets feature in Azure Mobile Services, I can use a third-party service that provides that feature for me. So here's one. There are a few of these on the market right now. Here's one called Pusher.com. This company is not Microsoft, it's some third-party company, and they provide what you might think of as WebSockets as a service. So you sign up to their service, and they will set up a WebSocket endpoint for you, and then they give you some APIs that you can call to connect people to it and to send messages and so on. And that's what I'm going to use, just to demonstrate that mobile services can connect to arbitrary third-party services. Okay. But before we get to that, we have to think a little bit about the business problem here. The business problem is, how do we display taxi positions in real time? Therefore, how do we know what the taxi positions are? Therefore, how do we even know who the taxis are? How do we know what taxis work for our company? Well, to model that, I've created a table called taxis. And in there, you can see that there are four taxis who currently work for my company: Axel, BD Joe, Gina, and Gus. Anyone know why they're called that? Family members? No. It's one of my favorite arcade games, the classic Sega arcade game Crazy Taxi. That's the characters in it. Anyway, those are the taxi drivers in the company, and we need to know where they are. So how are we going to do that? Well, probably the most cost-efficient way to do that would be to give each of these drivers a smartphone application that runs on their phone and uses the GPS on the device to report the position on a regular interval to the mobile service. And in fact, that's exactly what I've done. So I've created this Windows Phone 8 application here, which knows how to send its GPS location just with a single HTTP POST request to a mobile server. Now, I've built it with Windows Phone 8, but I could equally have done it for Android or iOS just as well, because we've got SDKs for those platforms as well. But I'm in Windows right now, so you know Windows Phone is quite convenient. Okay, but before we can use that, before it can call the server, there has to be something on the server that it can call. There needs to be some endpoint that we can make HTTP requests to. Now, that endpoint is not necessarily going to be a table. So we don't necessarily want to use a table script to implement this. But that's okay, because there's this other tab, API. And the API tab allows you to implement arbitrary endpoints that can be called with HTTP requests and write some custom logic that runs when they're called. So let's create one now. I'm going to create a custom API, and I'm going to call it notify taxi position. And the mobile and the Windows Phone apps are going to make requests to this endpoint. And I won't worry about permissions just yet. Now, you can see that you can configure permissions for all of the different HTTP methods that somebody might invoke on there. And you can also, of course, implement permissions logic using custom script. So if I go into there, you'll see that I can write some arbitrary script in there. And like I said, it's running inside Node.js, so you can write any Node code you like, and it should work OK in there. So before we actually do this for real, let's just log any requests that come in, just so that we can check that the requests are really working. So I'm just going to drop in a little bit of logging code that I've already prepared, just a tiny bit. So I'm saying, when there's a request, I want to log that taxi with some ID is at some position that it claims to be at. So let's hit save on that. And you're probably thinking, console log? What do you mean? Where's the console? And I will show you where the console is in a minute, and we will see the log requests coming in. So in my application, I could now start sending my GPS coordinates into the mobile service. But first, we should decide, which taxi is this? Is it BD Joe? Is it Gus? Is it Gina? Well, in a real taxi company, you need to be able to set up associations between bookings and taxis. So when someone places a booking, then presumably some boring person in an office somewhere presses a button to assign a booking to a particular taxi driver, and then that driver knows to go and pick up that person. So that's exactly what I'm doing in this case. I've created a little administrative interface, as you can see here. And it uses exactly the same data access techniques that you've already seen to get a list of the bookings, and then we can assign them to taxis. You can see that the design consultant, who I had to build that, has done a fine job. But before I actually do this, let's create a new booking that's more local to where we are, so we can see it at first hand. So let's go from IFEMA Madrid to Barajas. Is that how you say it? I don't really know. No, to the airport. Let's say Madrid Airport. There we go. That's what I want to go. And we'll place that booking right now. OK. So then someone in office can see that this booking has just come in and can assign it to a driver. So let's assign that to BD Joe here. He's my favorite driver. And then if I go into the list of bookings, assuming that my code has actually worked correctly, it should have added a new column called taxi ID, and you can see that that booking has been associated with this driver. So that's marvelous. Now, in my app, presumably if this was real, I would make the driver log in with an actual password. But because you know, it's a demo, I'm just going to let the driver choose their identity from a list. So I'll choose BD Joe, and now BD Joe will start reporting his GPS coordinates regularly to the back end. And that's going to invoke this Notify Taxi Positioned API, which is going to log messages to the console. So if everything is working together, I should be able to go to the Logs tab here. That's what the console is. And I should be able to see that at 3:07 p.m., that's London time, not Spain time, we receive this message from Taxi 2 saying that it's at this location. And we're going to keep on getting these messages every few seconds. And all these older messages, that's when I was testing this earlier. OK. So we know where the driver is now. And we can write some arbitrary script to do something with that information. Now, what do we want to do? Well, we want to somehow get it down to the browser through a WebSocket connection. Now, I've already signed up with pusher.com, and they've given me a WebSocket endpoint that I can use. And they've provided all this information about their APIs, and so I'm going to use that. Firstly, on the server, I need to send a message to Pusher to say, hey, here's a message about a taxi, please pass it on. So let's drop in a little bit of code. It's actually quite a chunk of code, so I'll have to go through it slowly here. So what I want to do is, firstly, I want to get a reference to the Pusher APIs. So, whoops, up here, you'll see I'm requiring the Pusher APIs. In Node.js, you use require statements to import modules of code. And then I've got that module. I can instantiate a new Pusher instance. And when I've got that Pusher instance, I can use it to send messages. Now, I have to decide which booking is this message about. So I need to find which booking is currently associated with this taxi. So I'm running a query on the server here to say, find me the booking that is associated with this particular taxi. And we'll grab that first booking that comes back. And assuming that we've got a booking then, we can trigger a message through Pusher to say that the booking with a certain ID has had its taxi position updated to this new latitude longitude. So a bit of code there, but not too bad. I'll hit save on that. And if that works now, then we should be able to see this working. So because this app is continually sending these messages, then it's continually invoking notify position, taxi position change, and so it should be continually sending messages to Pusher. Let's see that it really is. So if I go to Pusher's debug console now, we should be able to see, hopefully, these API messages start to appear. Every few seconds, we're going to have one of these messages to say, a booking with a certain ID is now at a certain position. So all that's left to do is catch these messages in the browser. So we need to use the Pusher APIs to connect to that WebSocket and get these messages and do something with it. So let's have a go at doing that. I'm going to go and use the Pusher APIs. So the first thing that you have to do is add a script reference. So here's a script tag that references the Pusher JavaScript library. And when you've got that, you can then use Pusher's APIs to connect to this WebSocket endpoint. And here's some code to do that. So this is the code I've just added. And it says, OK, create an instance of the Pusher object with this particular application key. And then using that, we can listen for messages called taxi position updated. And whenever one of those messages comes in, we're going to try and find the booking object that we've got in the browser that relates to that. So we'll search using grep through all of the bookings that we have to find the one with the matching ID. And assuming that we can find that booking, then we'll set the latitude-longitude property on it to be the message latitude-longitude that's come back through the WebSocket connection. Okay. And now we want to actually display this on the map. So firstly, I better add a property called taxi-lat-long onto this booking view model. So I'll add a property right here. And then I want to add an extra marker onto the map. So I'm creating an extra entry in this array with the label taxi, and it will be displayed at the taxi-lat-long property on this object with some color. All right, so we're very nearly done now. The only thing left is we need to tell Pusher which bookings we want to receive notifications about. So I'm going to add this extra line of code here that says, whenever we first load a booking, we're going to tell Pusher that we would like to have messages about that booking, please. And then, hopefully, it will work. So back in the browser, I'll hit reload. And then this booking, does it work? Yeah, it does. Okay, so this booking up here, you can see now that this third marker, taxi, has appeared, and our taxi is currently in the middle of this convention center. It would be nice if we could see the taxi driving around, because if it was driving around, then the GPS coordinates would be changing over time. Now, I can simulate that because the Windows Phone simulator allows you to define a route that you've recorded or just clicked on the map, and then it will change the GPS coordinates every few seconds. So now the GPS coordinates are changing, and so updated coordinates should be going down to the browser. And if we look closely, we will see our taxi is coming along the road to pick us up, and then we will be on our way. So that is probably the coolest taxi booking interface for any Madrid-based taxi company. And I think we've done a pretty good job for about half an hour's coding. So that's marvelous. I think the taxi's gone the wrong way, sadly, but that's OK. So we have implemented some real-time push stuff there, and that was very nice. And even though mobile services itself doesn't have WebSocket support, because it lets you write custom APIs, you can integrate with third parties that do that kind of thing. And that's very nice. OK, let's finish this off now. So let's think about these guys, mobiles, phones, and tablets. They're kind of important these days. And also these things, app stores. Is it common for companies to want to put their things on app stores? Yes, it is common. They do want to do that. But it's typically thought of as being quite hard to do that and needing specialist developers. And as a web developer, you might think, no, I'm not interested in that because I don't want to learn Objective-C or Java or anything like that. I don't want to be bothered with that stuff. Leave me alone. But if you think that, I think you would be missing out on a really good opportunity because it is possible to use your web skills to put applications into app stores, assuming that you architect them in a particular way. So let's see. Could we potentially take the taxi booking app that we've already made and turn it into a native app? If you're thinking that it's not realistically possible to build a web-based application that looks and feels like a native application, I would show you this example to discrete. So this is an app that I wrote 2-3 months ago, and obviously it's an iPhone application. And this is built with exactly the technologies that I've shown you today. So the UI is Knockout, and the back end is Azure Mobile Services. And as you can see, it looks exactly like a native app and feels like one as well. It's got all the right kind of transitions and animations and stuff, and that's just CSS. No magic frameworks, just a bit of CSS animation. Not that hard, to be completely honest. And I packaged it up using PhoneGap, which I'm sure many of you have heard of, but probably not very many of you have actually used. So with PhoneGap, you can take your HTML and JavaScript application, you can run it on the device, you can use mostly HTML controls, or you can use native controls. This map here that you just saw, that was the native iOS control. And you can do other things that interoperate with the native device, like working with the user's photo library, like my application does here. And then you can store all your data in mobile services on the back end. So that's an example. You don't necessarily have to go to such lengths to try and make it look native. Maybe you just want to use your company's own style to build an application. But you want to do it with HTML and JavaScript. So how about we try and take the taxi app and make it work inside a mobile device? Now, just to make things interesting, I'm going to do this on a Mac, and I'm going to try and build an iPad application. Now, of course, you could do this as an Android application or a Windows Phone or whatever, but you know, this is a Microsoft conference, so let's do an iPad application. So I've got PhoneGap installed already here, and by installed, I mean I unzipped it. That's how you install PhoneGap. And then when you want to build an iOS application, you go into this folder, lib iOS bin. Obviously, you have to read the documentation to know that you're supposed to do that. And then you run a tool called create. And what create does is it's basically file new project. It's scaffolding a new application for you. And it wants me to give it these three parameters. So firstly, it wants a path where I should store this. I'll store it on the desktop here, and I'll call it spa taxi iOS. Okay, it wants a package name. A package name is one of these silly reverse domain things, spa taxi. Doesn't matter what that is, just give it some name of your own. And then finally, it wants a project name, so let's call it spa taxi iOS. Okay, so that has now run. That's effectively file new project, and what it's done is it's created this folder that you might have just seen appear on the desktop. And if I go in there, you can see here's my new project. Now that's an Xcode project, so let's open it with Xcode. And when that pops up, I'll be able to run it in the iPad simulator. I'll show you the code in a second, but let's just get this thing running. So I'm going to compile that, and then I'll launch it in the simulator. When that pops up, low screen resolution here, so the display is kind of funny. But this is the iPad simulator. So you can see here's my home screen, blah, blah, blah. And here's the app that's actually there. So it's a real native app that you could deploy to the App Store if you wanted to. Let's see a little bit of the code, should we? So let's have a look. This thing on the left, this is very much like Solution Explorer in Visual Studio. And you can see here this frameworks thing. This is a list to all the references. So this is like your .NET references. Then you can see the set of classes that I've got. And if you look in there, if you look at the code, it's all this freaky Objective-C stuff, which as a web developer probably makes you feel queasy, and you don't want to know about that. So we'll ignore it. And then you can look in the www folder, and suddenly you might feel a lot more at home. Because in here, there's JavaScript, there's HTML, and there's CSS, and there's images. So this is just your front-end web technologies that you know and love. And you can put your application in there. So let's see if we can put this mobile, this spa taxi application in there, shall we? So let me just get rid of all that junk. So let's show this folder here, and I'm going to delete. I'll go into the www folder here, and I'll delete all of this junk that the file new project thing created for me. So go away. The only thing I'm going to keep is this JavaScript library. And now I want to copy and paste all of the code that we just wrote in Visual Studio. So if I go back onto where I've got that code, here it is. So I'm just going to copy all of those files that we wrote, and I'm going to drop them into the www folder here. Except I can get rid of admin, because we don't need the admin interface on the iPad. OK, so those are the same files that you saw before. And just to prove that, let's have a look at the actual contents of the file. So you can see here's the home page, and you see the same code that we had before with the profile editor and the view model stuff. And I have not changed this code at all. I have not changed a single character of it, apart from one thing that you have to change with PhoneGap is you have to add a reference to the Cordova JavaScript library. Cordova is another name for PhoneGap, so That's the JavaScript library for PhoneGap that I've just imported. Nothing else about it is different. But let's try running it. So I'm going to bring this up in the iPad simulator. And you can see it looks correct. And I can hopefully log in. So a login pops. Now, mobile services has a special support for logging in on mobile devices. So we've got a different kind of login screen here. But it's the same code that's working with it. So I'm going to log in with my fake credentials. And just so that you can't see my typing, I'll type that down there. And then I will authorize this application. And it should go back, and you can see, even though the screen resolution is very low, that I am logged in with that particular Twitter user, and I can go over onto my bookings now, and I've got the same stuff there, and you know, it behaves like an iPad application should with all the slidey stuff, and hopefully even all the real-time stuff will work as well. So if I simulate my taxi starting another little journey, so if I'm going to start this phone simulator driving around these pre-prepared points, then hopefully you will be able to see in the iOS app that the taxi's again driving around there. So we've got ourselves a nice little application that can be deployed to the App Store. Okay. Right then. So that is, I think, all that we want to accomplish. Oops, that's not what I wanted to show. I wanted to show my slides, which are here. All right, then. So let's summarize what we've done. We started off by establishing that our objective was to build sophisticated applications just using front-end technologies, just using HTML, CSS, and JavaScript without having to, you know, compile stuff and being able to deploy just by copying files. But it's necessary still to have a back-end, and you can create one yourself, or you can use Azure Mobile Services, which is there, ready to go, and it's very powerful and flexible. And then using that, we were able to load and save data. We were able to add authentication using a third-party provider. And then we were able to write some various bits of custom logic that would control what the user could do, including interoperating with a third-party service called Pusher and being able to do real-time notification through that. And then finally, because the application was built exclusively using front-end technologies, it was trivial to turn it into a PhoneGap application just by copying and pasting the files, and that is ready to be deployed to app stores now. And it would run just the same on an Android device, or it could be running Windows Store as well, just the same. So that is all I want to cover during this talk. Let me just give you a further overview of what's in mobile services. We started at the bottom by doing data storage, authentication, authorization. I showed you how we can use custom script with table APIs. Those are the REST APIs for when the user's getting, putting, posting, deleting stuff. And then you saw how we were able to create a custom API. Now, what I didn't show you during this talk is the right-hand half of that curve. And that's the more powerful stuff still. And that's the stuff that I'm going to cover in my talk tomorrow. So I'll be showing you how you can do native push notifications, not just WebSockets. I'll show you how you can do scheduled jobs to run custom code at arbitrary times, even when no one's on your app. Like if you want to run some job at 8 a.m. every day, you can do that. I'll also show you how you can connect your mobile service to a source control system so that you don't have to just write your code inside a web browser. And then I'll also show you the most powerful thing of all, which is how you can import third-party Node Package Manager modules, which are blocks of third-party code, to implement arbitrary things, very sophisticated things. So all that stuff is going to be in the talk tomorrow. And in the talk tomorrow, I won't be doing web-based coding. I'm going to be doing native code. So that will be building an iOS app, not with PhoneGap, but with Objective-C, and building an Android app with Java and Eclipse. Even though Eclipse makes my skin crawl, I will still do it because I'm that dedicated. Okay, so that's on at 12 o'clock tomorrow. There are also various resources that you can see. The only thing that's really important is that you fill out the evaluation. Please fill out the evaluation because that determines whether or not I can come back and do this next year. So it would be very useful if you could do that. I think we're all done now. Are there any questions? We've got a few minutes. No questions? Okay, great. Well, then, I'm going to be around at the front for a few minutes if you want to ask any questions in person. Otherwise, enjoy the rest of your day and come to the talk tomorrow. Thank you.